The following program contains graphic material, including offensive language. Viewer discretion is advised.
The Nicole Sandler Show. Questioning authority daily. And that could be the very reason why YouTube is upset. Hey, YouTube. The music bed you hear beneath my voice is from a broadcast sound library that I pay for and have the receipts. So I've got your copyright violation right here. And for the audience at home, this is the sound of Google executives with their brains on drugs. This is the sound of a motorcycle burning donuts on the grave of Lowry Mays. And now, here's Nicole.
Hey, it's Nicole Sandler here. I know it doesn't sound like me, that's because my voice is currently out of commission. So, I'm using the same type of technology that killed off radio to read the intro to today's show. Overall, it's been a really lousy day dealing with our horrific American for-profit health insurance industry masquerading as healthcare. I found out this morning that a medication that makes it possible for me to sleep at night, for which I had been paying $65 out of pocket each month, will now cost me 10 times that amount. I spent hours on the phone, explaining, cajoling, begging and crying to get a solution to this problem, but it only made me worse, to the point where I'm unable to do a show. Aside from the fact that my attention was taken from the most important news events in a generation when I'm in the news business. But it also messed with my psyche to the extent that the depression I've been fighting off successfully for a few months is now back with a vengeance. How anyone could fight to save this farce of a healthcare system is totally beyond my comprehension. We need Medicare for all. We need to get the money grabbers out of our healthcare and put it into the hands of actual healers and entities that actually give a shit about people instead of the just almighty dollar. So, I cannot cover today's impeachment proceedings for you, as is my job. And I feel really awful about that. Perhaps I can put together a special podcast over the weekend to include all the information I had for today's show that I cannot now professionally present. Instead, a sampling of what could be. Today, I'll share a collection of interviews with some of the best progressive primary challengers who will each hopefully unseat the Republican lights who call themselves Democrats who currently hold those seats. Every one of these candidates is an outspoken proponent of Medicare for all. We'll begin with the very awesome Marie Newman.
On the line with us is Marie Newman, and hopefully that name is familiar to you because Marie Newman ran in 2018 for the Democratic nomination for Congress from Illinois' 3rd Congressional District against incumbent Dan Lipinski. She should have won. She came very close, and thankfully she's running again, and I'm thrilled to welcome Marie Newman to the show. Hi, Marie. It's so nice to meet you.
Well, so nice to meet you, and thank you for having me, Nicole.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you for running again. As I said in the intro, you came very close to unseating Dan Lipinski in 2018. The difference came down to only around 2,000 votes. So what do you think happened there? You had a huge national profile, and it looked like the tides were with you, but the party was not. Was that the problem?
Yeah, you know, and so let's remember that, you know, organizations like the DNC and the DCCC and all of those folks are dedicated to expanding the party. The other big mission is to protect incumbents. Mm-hmm. And while that is not a bad mission in and of itself, it is a tricky position when you have incumbents that deserve to be primaried. And I really delineate very carefully because not every incumbent should be, in fact, most of them should not be primaried. There are some that are not in alignment with their district. And really, that's the litmus test for me. There's no other litmus test. When they say that there's, you know, there's like a party criteria and all of that, certainly you should broadly believe all of our democratic values to be part of the Democratic Party. But the most important thing, and I say this over and over again, is to be in alignment with your district. In my case, Dan Lipinski is dramatically out of alignment with the district. It's not just on one or two points. It is on 20. So that's the real issue there. Now, with regard to the party and why I lost. You never lose for one reason. You know what? Mm-hmm. It's always 74 mm-hmm. things. I could have done a better job in the field. Dan Lipinski was very effective in doing this very Trumpian tactic where he makes you out to be a one-trick pony. And we realized that we have to own our narrative and own our message, and we're not going to let him drive the show. And we've been very successful the second time in not letting him drive the show. And I think we're going to continue to do that. So those are among some of the things. You know, he also had organizations like No Labels come in yeah. and dump a couple $1 million on you know, saying like literally depraved things about
right,
my
attacking
kids
you. Right. People need to know about No Labels yeah. because they're not No Labels. They're a very conservative faction who you know, and the way they attacked you was just unconscionable. So, yeah, I'm glad you brought them up. Marie Newman, tell us yep. about the 3rd District of Illinois. Where is it? Who are the constituents there?
Sure. Yeah, it is. I call it the gorgeous mosaic because it is this amazing, hardworking, very close-knit district. We start in the city in the southwest corner of the city and go all the way out to through the southwest suburbs to the top of a town called Joliet, which is in another county in Will County. So we're we have city parts, we have suburban parts, we have exurban parts, and just a little bit of more rural areas. And so it's really an amazing mosaic of folks and places. And so, and not unlike the country, it's about 30% Latino Americans, and then about 9% Southeast Asian, Muslim, Arab American folks, and then there is just wide mix of kind of everything else you could possibly imagine. About 2 or 3% African American, about 1% Asian American, and then just you know fills in with a wide mix of everything.
Okay. Now, Dan Lipinski, obviously, I don't want to focus on him, but let's get this out of the way. He's a man whose father held this seat for a couple of decades before he took over. And I think he's now, this is his 6th or 7th term. And so,
it's 8, I think.
Yep. Oh my, okay. He voted against the Affordable Care Act. He opposed recognition of same-sex marriage. He initially voted against the DREAM Act. He co-chaired the Congressional Pro-Life Caucus and was the only Democrat who spoke at the March for Life last year. The National Right to Life Committee rates him as 75% pro-life. And I know he's positioned or tried to position you as, I don't know, somebody who wants to kill babies. This is right. what you're saying. He's out of touch with the district. I think he's out of touch with the yeah. state, and he's certainly out of touch with the Democratic Party. Before this cycle began, the DCCC, the faction of the Democratic Party who oversees the House elections, they issued new rules that basically blackballs any vendors, any consultants or researchers or marketing firms, any organization that works with a primary challenger. Do you think this was aimed at you in a vindictive way, perhaps, for coming close to beating one of them?
So this policy has actually been in place for, a couple of decades.
Oh, really?
It just was never enforced. Yeah, it's a little known fact. It actually has been in writing for, I want to say a couple of decades.
Wow.
The current leadership decided that she would enforce it. And that's her prerogative. She's the leader of that organization. I disagree with it vehemently. Mm-hmm. I think all it does is, first of all, it's undemocratic because it doesn't allow the democratic process to play out fairly. When you unduly disadvantage candidates that are challenging folks that are out of alignment with their districts, meaning incumbents, all that proves to do is to make it hard on people of color and women candidates that already have a tougher time fundraising and finding resources and consultants. So the blackballing of consultants that were going to work with primary challengers for me was just undemocratic.
Mm-hmm. Well, it is. It is. That's the definition of not democratic. I think it's just a horrific policy that just shows that the Democratic Party is not Democratic. So has this affected you? Have you lost?
Early it did. It was a pretty bad stub toe because I had all of my, I had gotten out there very early in January and started putting all the pieces together, right? Mm-hmm. And we started hearing about this list and the blackballing, in March, and I announced in April. Well, the day before I announced, four of my consultants who had been fighting off the DCCC very effectively, they were threatened in any number of ways. They were threatened that, you know, they'd never work on the House floor again, that they'd never work with any DCCC candidates, that they would never work with any nonprofits that worked with DCCC candidates, and legal action and a bunch of things. And, you know, you have to remember, all these consultants are small business owners, as was I, and I know what it's like to feed a family. And, you know, so I wasn't mad at the consultants at all. I just thought it was like, it was straight up bullying at the end of the day. You can protect your incumbent in another way. You don't have to pull these types of tricks. In any event, we got up over and beyond it. It was extremely, extremely expensive for my campaign. It probably at the end of the day cost us about $100,000. It was $100,000 that I didn't want to re-raise, so to speak. You know, it's like, it was very wasteful. That's the other thing too. Like, you have to understand, I'm cheap as all get out, and so to waste money really bugged me. You know, we got up and over and beyond it in a matter of a couple of months. But I had the most concerning part was that there was no pollster that would work with me because they literally feared for their livelihood that they would be able to work again. And so we finally found these two very bold women that were excellent at their jobs. One of them was semi-retired and the other was retired. And you know what? They're kind of crushing it. And guess what? We're innovating in the way we're polling. We're getting ridiculously accurate polling, and just I wish I had found them first.
Wow. So, well, that's awesome.
Really good stuff.
It's a silver lining then. And hopefully we can get Sheree Bustos out of her position heading up the DCCC when more Democrats like you, progressives, are elected to the House in 2020. We're speaking with Marie Newman. By the way, her website is marienewmanforcongress.com. Marie has been endorsed by Blue America. Howie Klein put us together to talk, and my listeners know Howie very well. He's on my show every Thursday, and they know that if Howie and Blue America endorses someone, that you know that they are progressive. Another thing about you and most of the candidates that Blue America endorses, if we go to your website, you very clearly list your position on tons of issues. It's interesting that some of the more conservative Democrats don't list their policy positions, I guess because they want to be able to, I don't know, backtrack or not take a stand on something that could be controversial. You let us know where you stand, and I truly appreciate that. I'm going to ask you a question that I hate. I always get these fundraisers from the party. And by the way, I contribute directly to a candidate or through Blue America rather than going through the DCCC, which is what everyone should do. But anyway, they put these fundraising emails in the guise of a survey. Like, what is the most important issue to you? And I don't know. It's really hard for me to say, well, healthcare is more important than children being caged at the border or separated from their parents or, you know, getting money out of politics, things like that. It's hard to prioritize them. So I apologize for asking. What are the most important issues to you, Marie Newman?
Yeah, you know, and I don't mind that question because, interestingly, what's important to me is the same as what's important to the district. But here's what I will tell you, too, is that because the way I operate when I have been a nonprofit leader, a business leader, or an advocacy leader, it is what is most important to the cause. It doesn't matter what I think, but in this particular situation, the district and I are in lockstep. Mm-hmm. So the thing that's most important is healthcare. We need healthcare for all in this nation. I have had 257 meet and greets since January, and in every one of them, somebody tells me that either someone in their family or they themselves have been bankrupted by, and some of them were on Obamacare. So it's, you know, we are where we are. Healthcare is the number one issue in the nation, is the number one issue in my district. You know, I think the other things that are very important to the district And not necessarily in perfect order, but the top three or four are, the next one is the income divide. 80% of this nation is either frequently, sometimes, or always living paycheck to paycheck. I lived paycheck to paycheck. Doesn't feel good. I know exactly what it's like to play Russian roulette with your bills.
Mm-hmm.
It's, you know, that's very, very important. So things like raising wages, empowering unions, creating, implementing Medicare for All so that we can take healthcare off the onus of small business. Small business is about 54% of the GDP. You know, we should be nurturing it, not hitting it. And, you know, then some of the other things that are very important to the district are immigration. So I call it immigration transformation. I don't call it reform because reform suggests we did something wrong. Hmm. And the meaning that the immigrants did something wrong and they haven't is that, you know, what I believe is that it's not just a legislative proposal. It is an attitudinal proposal where we should be get back to our roots and be a welcoming nation. No one's here from here originally, except for indigenous people, right? We should be opening up our arms to everybody and creating a path to citizenship, creating in each post office and library a place to go where people that are new to our country, whether they are guests or they are immigrants, that they can find access to affordable housing, healthcare, and a job. And that's something we should do with, you know, leveraging our existing assets. So immigration transformation, very important. And then gun safety and prevention of gun violence, very important in our district. Mm. I'm the former spokesperson for Moms Demand Action, and I've helped pass legislation. So you know, one could say that because I've worked on economic rights and gun safety reform and anti-bullying laws, that, you know, I may have worked on more legislation actively than Dan did. So,
right.
Those are kind of the top things. But, you know, it's just like any, you know, there are geographic regions inside the district that have other needs, a long list of 20 topics probably.
Right. And on the website, you do have not only your issues page, but also your Illinois 3rd District priorities. Yeah. Something that frankly, not every candidate does. So you are obviously aligned with the district. Marie Newman is with us. I know you've told this story before, but for those who haven't heard you, can you explain why you decided to run back in 2018?
Yeah, in 2018, and it hasn't changed dramatically. Uh-huh. In 2018, when we got close to the election in November of 2017, I tell my husband that, because I'm kind of a right brain, left brain person. In my former positions, I worked with a lot of data, so I really appreciate data, but I also believe in qualitative information. And I just had a feeling about 6 weeks out from the election that Trump was going to be able to win this thing with data, and he did. I just I call it my mom gut.
Mm-hmm.
And so I just had a feeling, and I walked across the room and said, I think he's going to win this thing, and this is going to change our country forever, and we're going to be rolled back 20 years. And actually, my husband, who is a strong Democrat, said, okay, well, first of all, I can't imagine that he'll win, but second of all, we have to give him a chance. And so that day when he did win, my husband was really disgusted, went to bed early when it was clear that Hillary couldn't win. And I stayed up and watched the whole horror show.
Mm-hmm.
And the next morning I woke up, stayed in my pajamas, was literally, and I am not a crier. I didn't even cry when my kids were born. Like, I cried all day. Like,
yeah,
I
you just, weren't alone.
Yeah. Right. And so I stayed in pajamas all day, never did that. I canceled all my meetings, never did that. And I filled out an application to Illinois Women's Institute for Leadership and said, you know, I have got to get more engaged. And I had been watching Lipinski for years. Look, I didn't like his policies for a long time. I just didn't know how bad everything was. You know, I knew that he was anti-choice, but I'm like, you know what? There are several politicians that are anti-choice. I can't agree with everything on everything that they do. But then when I went down the whole list and, you know, he's voted against workers' rights. He has voted against Obamacare. He is anti-immigrant severely and very sadly, and on and on and on. And I'm like, nobody takes this guy on because everybody's afraid of the Chicago machine.
Mm-hmm.
With reason, by the way. I learned the hard way.
Right.
You know, that's when I decided, I was like, you know what, this guy is completely out of alignment with the district. That was, again, my hunch. But then when I did a really formal cross data analysis on attitudes in the district, we learned, sure enough, like there were literally 8 or 9 things where he was had a space of about 40% attitudinally between the district and himself. It wasn't just 1 or 2 things. And I was like, wow, this needs to be changed. We can't have folks like this ruling the roost. So went through my leadership training with Illinois Women's Institute and then launched a run in, I think, March of 2018. As you know, we ran. We got within 2%.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason that I ran again is because I kept working in the district. The day after I got, I lost, I jumped on several other campaigns to help other candidates inside the district, and then our governor's race and 3 other congressional races. I helped them all. And what I learned was is people really wanted me to run again. And I was like, so then I launched an exploratory in January of this year, and just to confirm that people wanted me to run, and did about, I don't know, 50 meet and greets before I announced in April, and here we are.
Awesome. Well, Marie Newman, you may have one of the highest profiles of any primary challenger in the country, again, because there was such great progressive support for you in the last election. You came so close, and it's obvious that the DCCC had their finger on the scale to protect Dan Lipinski. Why? It makes no sense, because he's certainly out of line with where most of us are today. And you've gotten a lot of support, obviously, just continuing from last time. I know a lot of the support from people already in Congress is more private. Who's come out and endorsed you publicly?
Oh, sure. So Congressman Ro Khanna, Congresswoman Alexandria
Ocasio-Cortez.
Cortez. and as well as Pramila Jayapal came out
awesome.
Last week
oh,
for me.
Great.
And then, I'm missing one. Oh, Jan Schakowsky.
Oh, nice. Oh, from Illinois. So a colleague there. And that's important because somebody else in the congressional delegation from Illinois is coming out for you against the incumbent. That's a big deal.
Right. You know, and interestingly, too, that that is not an easy decision to make. And it was hard for Jan the first time to make that decision. Where she landed was that she saw what I saw, that this is a complete disservice to this district to have this person in place that really doesn't have anywhere near the same values, is completely out of alignment, and by the way, is not active or effective anyway. I mean, he hasn't passed any laws on his own. He hasn't written laws. I mean, he just is inactive and just doesn't get a whole lot done and is inactive in the district. So, you know, I think that Jan looked at all of it in the sum total and where she saw the country going, and she realized, well, that I've got to get behind her and take a very huge political risk. And that takes a lot of courage. But that kind of defines all of those people that have endorsed me. And, you know, I have 4 sitting senators that have endorsed me as well. Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren and Kirsten Gillibrand and Cory Booker have all endorsed me.
Nice.
So they all have a lot of political courage to endorse against a sitting member of Congress.
Most definitely. And we need more to show courage like that, because, you know, there's often when you're looking at a primary race, not such a stark divide. It's very clear the differences between Marie Newman and Dan Lipinski. And I think it should be a no-brainer. Hopefully now with the national recognition you already enjoy, and people like Jan Schakowsky and Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren stepping up early, this will bode well for you. When is Illinois' primary?
It is March 17th, St. Patrick's Day in Chicago.
Oh, boy. So you'll be celebrating, yep, hopefully, on the green Chicago River. Marie Newman, it's a pleasure to meet you. Thank you so much for making the time for us. I've been a fan of yours. I followed your campaign last time and was frankly devastated that you came so close and didn't win. I feel good this time. I think you should too. Thank you. People can go to marienewmanforcongress.com. I'll put links on my page, on Brad Friedman's bradblog.com page as well. And I look forward to speaking with you again and calling you Congresswoman.
Well, thank you very much, Nicole, and thank you for making time for me. And thank you to all of your listeners. I really appreciate the time today. And I hope everybody has a wonderful holiday season and a happy new year.
Marie Newman, primarying the horrible Dan Lipinski in Illinois. Third congressional district, that primary election is coming up on March 17th. If you've just tuned in and are wondering what is this strange voice, well, this is a computer-generated voice reading Nicole Sandler's words as she's had the day from hell dealing with our fucked-up U.S. system of for-profit health insurers deciding what kind of medical care we get. Nicole has been sidelined by today's many frustrations. So she's taking advantage of some interviews she recorded over the holidays with great progressive congressional candidates and of the technology that allows some creepy disembodied voice devoid of emotion or humanity to put out a show today. What she really feels badly about is her temporary inability to cover the most important and consequential news event, the impeachment of the president, in real time. Thanks again, medical insurance industrial complex. Our next candidate isn't looking to primary another Democrat, but to oust a Republican from what should be a blue seat.
On the line with us now is Mike Siegel. He is the Blue America endorsed candidate running for Congress from Texas's 10th district. Hey, Mike, thanks for joining us today.
Hey, Nicole. Great to be on. Thanks for having me.
You are in the Austin, Texas area. I'm not a big fan of Texas, but Austin is... well, to me, it's not really part of Texas. To you, it is part of Texas. In fact, Austin's the capital of Texas, right?
Right.
But if I am reading things correctly, Austin, home of University of Texas, a very progressive enclave, a great music town, an amazing city by all accounts, is split into so many districts. Was this obviously done intentionally, gerrymandered, to keep a progressive base from having representation in Congress?
Yes, it was. But, you know, first of all, on behalf of Texas, we want to invite you to come out. There are many lovely towns here in addition to Austin, including several in the Texas 10th Congressional District. But, yeah, this district, like the six districts that touch parts of Austin, were all gerrymandered back in 2004 by Tom DeLay and Karl Rove, when they basically did a dramatic restructuring of the map here in Texas and turned what is largely a Democratic area into five Republican seats and one Democratic congressional
seat.
Wow.
Wow. So the 10th seat, 10th district, is where do you fall geographically in relation to Austin?
Sure. So this is a seat that historically was actually the seat of Lyndon B. Johnson and other notable Democrats. And it used to basically be a big chunk of Austin, and then it went west to what we call the Hill Country. But now it has been drawn to touch nine counties. It starts out northwest of Austin, has about 25% of the town, and then goes east across seven rural counties and ends up in these Harris County, Houston suburbs to the northwest of Houston. These are basically like white flight towns that in the 80s, you know, when people left the cities, a lot of the Republicans landed in these towns called Katy and Cypress. And they've historically been very Republican, although they're changing over time.
And who represents the 10th district now?
So Michael McCaul is the representative. He won his first Republican primary after the gerrymander. He spent several million dollars. And basically after that has put his feet up. The Democrats didn't even field a candidate against him in the first election. That's how severely gerrymandered this district was.
Wow.
But McCaul is one of the wealthiest members of Congress. He's worth over $300 billion.
Oh, my.
He most recently served as the chairman of the Homeland Security Committee, overseeing the family separation crisis, among other terrible policies. And he's been, you know, steadily kissing up to Trump, hoping to get an appointment to a cabinet position, although he hasn't achieved that yet.
So we are obviously in primary season. Do you have any opponents in a primary here?
I do. I think to some extent we're a victim of our own success. You know, last cycle I was the Democratic nominee in this district, and it was considered to be a safe Republican seat. And, you know, McCaul started out with a 19% advantage. But I put together a really broad, progressive grassroots campaign with unions and environmental groups and progressives. And we narrowed the gap with 1,000 volunteers from 19% to 4%
wow.
on Election Day.
Wow.
And so now, yeah, I made a lot of great progress. And now this is on all the lists of the national battleground seats, one of the 10 or 15 seats Democrats can pick up in 2020. And unfortunately, two people that were previously supporters of my campaign decided that they wanted this seat, and they decided to challenge me in the primary.
Oh, no. Well, hopefully you'll beat them out of the race quickly, and they'll come on board and support you. We're speaking with Mike Siegel. So you've got the name recognition because you ran in the last cycle and you obviously built a good following. So building on that, and sometimes it takes a few tries to get in, but it sounds like you're well positioned. Why are you running for this seat?
Well, first of all, you know, to provide actual representation. I alluded to how McCall is basically in this elitist culture, and he's not really in touch with the district. And there are real needs here. I mean, this is a district that includes 7 rural counties that three rural hospitals have closed in the last 10 years, in part because Republicans refused to expand Medicaid in Texas. So our tax dollars are funding Medicaid expansion around the country, but not here in Texas. We have a severe environmental crisis. We have coal ash deposits from a power plant in the district. We have unregulated fracking that's polluting the groundwater. And so folks in the rural counties can't even get, clean drinking water here in the district. McCall has been on the wrong side of this horrible immigration policy by President Trump and is basically allowing Trump to do whatever he wants. And so basically what I'm proposing is to run a real grassroots, ground-up campaign that's responsive to the needs of the people. We're on the ground in the rural counties, the suburbs, as well as the cities, and basically showing folks what real representation would look like. You know, I'll show up and knock on your door and listen to you, and we'll advocate on local issues as well as national issues.
Nice. What's your background, Mike Siegel? What brings you, how did you get to this point?
Thank you. Yes. Basically 21 years of public service. You know, after college, I joined the teaching corps as a public school teacher and taught 3rd grade and 5th grade and 8th grade. I was also active in the teachers union and was part of this fight against the privatization of public education. Later did go to law school. My parents tried to convince me not to. They said being a teacher is the most useful thing you can do in this world.
Wow.
Although they're both lawyers at this point. So it was a little do as I say, doing as I do. But I was a civil rights lawyer, taking on discrimination cases as a plaintiff's attorney, representing women who suffered discrimination, whistleblowers who suffered retaliation. And most recently, I've been a city attorney for the city of Austin, where my job for a few years was basically to go to City Hall, sue the Republican governor, and go home, basically standing up for immigrant communities, low-income renters, trying to keep guns out of City Hall because this is Texas, and we get sued by the attorney general if we don't allow guns in our city building.
Wow. So you come from an education background, but also a law background, and you see the need. Now, there is talk about Texas at least turning somewhat purple. And we saw, you know, how close Beto O'Rourke came to unseating Ted Cruz. I mean, that by all rights, if you look historically at Texas, that should have been a huge defeat, and it was actually a competitive race. Do you see the tides turning in Texas rather than just in the Austin area, which is pretty blue? How do you see the rest of the state?
Yes, certainly. And Beto gets a lot of credit. You know, he campaigned in all 254 counties of Texas and really mobilized folks who hadn't been engaged in the process. But really, this is something that's been simmering and developing for many years prior to the last election. This lawsuit I was a part of at the city attorney's office, suing the governor to stop Senate Bill 4, was illustrative. You may know that in 2017, Texas passed a Show Me Your Papers law. It was modeled on that earlier Arizona law, and it was really an attack on the immigrant community, our Texas Republicans kissing up to Trump and his anti-immigrant agenda. And as part of that lawsuit, the city of Austin, to stand up for our immigrant community, built a coalition of the largest cities in the state. And so it wasn't just us suing, but it was Houston, it was Dallas, it was San Antonio, it was El Paso. And for the first time in history, really, all the big cities joined together to sue the governor to stop this law. And that shows how, we have a saying among Texas Democrats that we're not a red state, that we're actually a non-voting state. And that's really true, that there hasn't really been this base building that's occurred in Texas for Democrats. You know, the party has been pretty weak overall, especially the Texas State Party. There hasn't been a lot of organizing in the Black community and the Latino community. And so a lot of folks have been left behind and have basically been disengaged from the process, in part because of voter suppression, by the Republicans, and in part because of faults on our side. And so what's been happening is there's been a greater commitment to organizing with students, organizing in the Latino community, organizing on an intersectional basis to really build a broader base. And so, you know, Beto's work was a great part of this effort last cycle. In Harris County, where Houston is, basically Democrats swept every countywide office, first time that's ever happened.
Wow.
And so there's a lot of wonderful signs across the state of this growing movement. Now, I'm not sure we can flip to statewide seats in 2020. I'm not sure we have a candidate that can really, galvanize the state in that way. But we can certainly pick up a lot more congressional seats and state house seats, and maybe even affect the redistricting process that's going to occur in 2021.
Oh, please. Again, we're speaking with Mike Siegel, who is running for Congress for the Democratic nomination at this point to be in the general election to represent Texas's 10th district. The website is siegelfortexas.org, and I'm looking at it right now, and thank you for putting real explanations of where you stand on the issues. One thing I learned from Howie Klein of Blue America is those who tend to lean more conservative Democratic tend not to publish their stances on issues. But you have a very inclusive section on issues on the website. The first one you address is health care for all. So it's interesting you put it healthcare for all. Are you a proponent of Medicare for all? What's your ideal vision for healthcare in America?
I am a proponent of Medicare for all, and if you actually click through, you'll see that stated pretty clearly. You know, in this district, I've found that a lot of folks aren't really up to date on the policy debates we're having on Twitter, for example. And so they don't actually know what Medicare for all means. And so oftentimes I lean into the issue by describing what we're demanding, you know, basically a single payer system that's free at the point of service, no co-pays, no deductibles, and you'll never have a doctor or a specialist who is out of network. And I find that leaning into it with a more generic description helps to open up the conversation. Unfortunately, because of this presidential debate and some of the kind of right-wing attacks by some of the Democratic candidates, there's a lot of confusion about what Medicare for all means.
Yes,
but I'm very clear that in this district it would be a life-saving policy initiative, that it would keep rural hospitals open. I mean, in these rural counties where the hospital is closed, these folks have to think about driving 60 or 90 minutes to get decent health care.
If
you know, they're giving birth to a child or have a severe medical emergency. And part of that is because the federal government isn't reimbursing for the indigent care and other needs of the local hospital. We have tens of thousands of people who are facing bankruptcy because they don't have adequate care. And this idea that you know, Medicare for all who want it, which one of my primary opponents is backing in line with Mayor Pete, you know, that's not going to achieve the savings we need. That's actually going to be a real, you know, false flag, I would suggest. One analogy I make is to public education, you know, and how charter schools are kind of put forward as choice, right?
Yeah.
But when you have charter schools in general, when you have like a larger system of charter schools, what they do is they weaken the public school systems, and then the school districts become a dumping ground for the most vulnerable students and the least engaged families. These are the students that are like the most expensive to provide good education for. And unfortunately, if we have Medicare for all who want it, that's what's going to happen to the Medicare system. The most expensive patients are going to be there, while the folks who have less expensive needs are going to be on private insurance. And that way, Medicare is going to fail. And so I see Medicare for all who want it as a setup and something we really have to advocate against.
Great. Obviously, you've got a great understanding of the issue. And you're able to explain it in a way that those who don't follow it as closely as we do will understand. So thank you for that. I'm seeing on the website you have, in addition to healthcare, protect the right to vote, education, Green New Deal, expanding labor rights, corporate PAC money, pro-choice, common sense gun reforms, which you brought up before. Being in Texas, is this a tough topic to tackle, gun reform?
Well, you know, I think it goes back to your theory of how we win. I mean, do we win by kind of appealing to, you know, former Trump voters or, you know, moderates who lean Republican, or do we expand the base?
Mm-hmm.
You know, polls show that across Texas, huge majorities of people support common sense gun reforms, whether it's red flag laws, universal background checks, even eliminating the sale of assault rifles. And the only reason we're not getting these reforms passed is because the NRA has bought and sold our elected officials, right? And so when I talk about gun reform, I have to talk about it in two parts. I mean, one, it's these common sense reforms that 90% or more of Texans agree with, but it's also about getting corporate money out of politics and getting rid of the NRA, which is buying our politicians and disenfranchising our voters. You know, I think that, you know, some of the folks in the rural communities will tell me, you know, we'd rather you not talk about guns as much.
Right.
'Cause we have gun culture here. And, you know, Democrats and Republicans alike, when you're in these rural towns with maybe less public services, it's a part of public safety, being able to defend yourself. And so I'm not here saying we're going to take guns away from people. You know, I respect the Second Amendment, at least not the full interpretation that the Supreme Court has gone to, that we need unregulated firearms in private hands. But the idea that you can defend yourself with a firearm makes sense to me. But to talk about these things in a way that's that kind of brings in the corruption angle, I find to be very appealing across voter segments, you know, because people can understand the corruption of our politics.
Good. You also have issue pages on crushing college debt and criminal justice reform. You know, I get emails, despite unsubscribing over and over again from the DCCC and the DNC, they keep sending me these emails and they ask, you know, it's under the guise of a survey. Of course, it's all designed to get a contribution. But they in many cases will ask you to rate in order of importance which issues you most care about. I hate those questions because I don't know how I can prioritize, you know, climate change over healthcare for all, over, you know, stopping the separation of children from their parents and locking them up at the border. I mean, there's so many things and I can't prioritize them. Can you? Is there one issue above all others that is your main driving force that you want to go to Congress and get this done?
Well, I agree. And a lot of these issues intersect because if we don't have strong health care, how are we going to be able to fight for a Green New Deal?
Yeah.
You know, how are we going to fight for our planet if we can't take care of ourselves? And so these things are interrelated. You know, I find the ones that I'm able to talk most forcefully about are health care, the Green New Deal, and voting rights, because I have different ways to link these issues to the work I'm doing and the leadership I've shown. I think that talking about the Green New Deal is particularly interesting in this context that I'm in, because the Texas 10th not only has this coal plant that's powering Austin in the middle of the district that's polluting the groundwater, but it also has a portion of what they call the oil patch, which is these Harris County or Houston area towns where a lot of people work in oil and gas. And so it's considered controversial for me to talk about climate change in this strong way. But I feel like it's essential that we talk about the Green New Deal in districts like this one, because if we can win on the Green New Deal in a Houston area district, that's going to be a tremendous boon to the national conversation. And so what I've done is, you know, we organized the first town hall in Texas, organized by a congressional campaign on the Green New Deal. I've been bringing together labor, which is a key part of this conversation. You might be aware that, you know, when the Green New Deal was launched, that some segments of labor weren't on board. And especially the laborers, the electrical workers who work at these coal plants, these are key unions with a major influence nationally, that if we're talking about a program that is essentially a jobs program, because that's what the Green New Deal is, right? It's like a huge investment in maybe a million or 2 million jobs nationally,
right,
to create a new style of economy. Organized labor needs to be on the at the table with us, you know, bought into the program. And so part of what I've been trying to do is, you know, balance my strong support with both labor and Greens and come together to forge this agenda for a Green New Deal. And one of the pitches I've been making is that, okay, if you get me, I'm going to support these national progressive ideas, but then I'm going to bring it home and we're going to focus on this stay-at coal plant. This facility that was opened 40 years ago, they promised it was going to be clean coal. Of course it wasn't. Acid rain has been raining down on that community, poisoning livestock, polluting the groundwater, causing cancer, causing asthma, all these things. And it's compounded by fracking that's unregulated. And so if I get in there and I can get on the right subcommittee, we'll hold a hearing about this coal plant. We'll develop the record to close it and then also get the Superfund money or other funds to refurbish this space, make it some sort of a sustainable industry for the future.
Have you noticed a change in attitudes among people, especially in the Houston area, following the massive floods? I mean, it was Hurricane Harvey, but then there was another a flooding event in this last year as well, if I recall correctly. Are you seeing a change in attitudes about climate change there due to the effects that are playing out in real time there?
Yes, certainly. And it's even surprising to me. So in the Houston area, we have had 500-year floods in 5 years.
Mm.
Wow. And so it sounds illogical, but these are a flood events that are supposed to occur once every 500 years.
Right.
And we've had five of them in the last 5 years. And so
recently
I was at a building trades council, and these are historically some of the more moderate unions, right? These are folks that depend upon their jobs from the development industry or from the fossil fuel industry. And so historically, not very left-wing unions.
Mm-hmm.
But their families have been flooded out. They've lost lives. They've lost their homes. And so and they're very aware that climate change is, at least in part, exacerbated by human activity. And so what I get from them is that they want to take action on climate change. I mean, they not only care about clean air and clean water, they want to avoid these flood events. But at the same time, they want assurances that their families aren't going to suffer when we make these macro changes. And I think that's where we really need to talk about this idea of a just transition. You know, the idea that the workers who are in the fossil fuel industries, the government is going to guarantee their economic security as we transition to a renewable economy. And, you know, Bernie has a pretty good plan about that, a 5-year transition period of guaranteed income. But they basically want to hear that our demands for taking care of the workers are just as specific as our demands for getting rid of fossil fuels. And so that's the conversation we really need to have going forward.
Awesome. His name is Mike Siegel, Democrat for Congress in Texas's 10th district. When is your primary there?
March 3rd.
March 3rd. All right. So we're coming up on it. Siegel for Texas.org. It's I before E, S-I-E-G-E-L for Texas.org is the website. Mike Siegel, it was a pleasure meeting you. I wish you the best of luck. And, I take Howie Klein's and Blue America's endorsements very seriously. And if Howie Klein says you're the guy, then you're the guy. So great to meet you. Thank you for joining us today. And go get them in March.
Well, thanks so much, Nicole. I appreciate all of your work highlighting these important issues and look forward to talking to you again.
That's Mike Siegel, running for the Democratic nomination for Congress from Texas's 10th district. Well, we don't have time to fit in another full candidate interview. So in the last few minutes together today, we'll return to the impeachment trial. The Democrats wrap up their 24 hours of opening arguments today. Again, Nicole Sandler apologizes for being unable to be here in person with you today, and puts full blame on our horrible profit-driven health insurance system masquerading as healthcare. For the last few minutes of today's show, we'll turn the microphone over to Adam Schiff, who's been doing a remarkable job as lead House impeachment manager in the Senate trial. Here's how he closed things out on Thursday evening.
But even now, our ally can't get his foot in the door. Even now, our ally can't get his foot in the door. And this brings me to the last point I want to make tonight, which is, when we're done, we believe that we will have made the case overwhelmingly of the president's guilt. That is, he's done what he's charged with. He withheld the money. He withheld the meeting. He used it to coerce Ukraine to do these political investigations. He covered it up. He obstructed us. He's trying to obstruct you. And he's violated the Constitution. But I want to address one other thing tonight. Okay, he's guilty. Okay, he's guilty. Does he really need to be removed? Does he really need to be removed? We have an election coming up. Does he really need to be removed? He's guilty. You know, is there really any doubt about this? I mean, do we really have any doubt about the facts here? Does anybody really question whether the president is capable of what he's charged with? No one is really making the argument, Donald Trump would never do such a thing. Because of course we know that he would, and of course we know that he did. It's a somewhat different question, though, to ask, okay, it's pretty obvious, whether we can say it publicly or we can't say it publicly, we all know what we're dealing here with this president. But does he really need to be removed? And this is why he needs to be removed. Donald Trump chose Rudy Giuliani over his own intelligence agencies. He chose Rudy Giuliani over his own FBI director. He chose Rudy Giuliani over his own national security advisors. When all of them were telling him this Ukraine 2016 stuff is kooky, crazy Russian propaganda, he chose not to believe them. He chose to believe Rudy Giuliani. That makes him dangerous to us, to our country. That was Donald Trump's choice. Now, why would Donald Trump believe a man like Rudy Giuliani over a man like Christopher Wray? Okay? Why would anyone in their right mind believe Rudy Giuliani over Christopher Wray? Because he wanted to, and because what Rudy was offering him was something that would help him personally. And what Christopher Wray was offering him was merely the truth. What Christopher Wray was offering him was merely the information he needed to protect his country and its elections. But that's not good enough. What's in it for him? What's in it for Donald Trump? This is why he needs to be removed. Now, you may be asking, how much damage can he really do in the next several months until the election? A lot. A lot of damage. Now, we just saw last week a report that Russia tried to hack, or maybe did hack, Burisma. Okay? I don't know if they got in. I'm trying to find out. My colleagues on the Intel Committee, House and Senate, we're trying to find out, did the Russians get in? What are the Russian plans and intentions? Well, let's say they got in. And let's say they start dumping documents to interfere in the next election. Let's say they start dumping some real things they hacked from Burisma. Let's say they start dumping some fake things they didn't hack from Burisma, but they want you to believe they did. Let's say they start blatantly interfering in our election again to help Donald Trump. Can you have the least bit of confidence that Donald Trump will stand up to them and protect our national interest over his own personal interest? You know you can't, which makes him dangerous to this country. You know you can't. You know you can't count on him. None of us can. None of us can. What happens if China got the message? Now, you can say, well, he's just joking. Of course, he didn't really mean China should investigate the Bidens. You know that's no joke. Now, maybe you could have argued 3 years ago when he said, hey, Russia, if you're listening, hack Hillary's emails. Maybe you could give him a freebie and say he was joking. But now we know better. Hours after he did that, Russia did, in fact, try to hack Hillary's emails. There's no mulligan here when it comes to our national security. So what if China does overtly or covertly start to help the Trump campaign? You think he's going to call him out on it? Or you think he's going to give him a better trade deal on it? Can any of us really have the confidence that Donald Trump will put his personal interests ahead of the national interest? Is there really any evidence in this presidency that should give us the ironclad confidence that he would do so? You know you can't count on him to do that. That's the sad truth. You know you can't count on him to do that. The American people deserve a president they can count on to put their interest first. To put their interest first. Colonel Vindman said, here right matters. Here, right matters. Well, let me tell you something. If right doesn't matter, if right doesn't matter, it doesn't matter how good the Constitution is. It doesn't matter how brilliant the framers were. It doesn't matter how good or bad our advocacy in this trial is. It doesn't matter how well written the oath of impartiality is. If right doesn't matter, we're lost. If the truth doesn't matter, we're lost. The framers couldn't protect us from ourselves if right and truth don't matter. And you know that what he did was not right. You know, that's what they do in the old country that Colonel Vindman's father came from, or the old country that my great-grandfather came from, or the old countries that your ancestors came from, or maybe you came from. But here, right is supposed to matter. It's what's made us the greatest nation on earth. No constitution can protect us. Right doesn't matter anymore. And you know, you can't trust this president to do what's right for this country. You can trust he will do what's right for Donald Trump. He'll do it now. He's done it before. He'll do it for the next several months. He'll do it in the election if he's allowed to. This is why, if you find him guilty, you must find that he should be removed. Because right matters. Because right matters. And the truth matters. Otherwise, we are lost.
Congressman Adam Schiff, who will likely emerge from this mess of an administration with newfound respect and fame. He is doing a great job in this role, running the impeachment for the Democrats. Now, if we could only get the Republicans to stay in their seats, listen to the evidence and, oh yeah, allow new evidence and witnesses to testify. The Senate will be back in session tomorrow. They'll be at it every day except Sundays. Tomorrow, Saturday, is when the Republicans take over for 24 hours of rebuttal over up to 3 days. Should be fascinating, or not. Once again, I'm a program Nicole found online that has a disembodied, non-human, and emotional voice read the words she's written. Nicole should be back next week, hopefully with a positive update to our insurance industry woes, though probably not. Until then, good luck to us all.